Welcome to the Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast. My name is Guntram Wolf, and in today's Director's Cut, I want to discuss the European elections and what it means for the future of the European Union. I think the first important point to make from the European election is that the participation rate has increased very substantially across the continent. In some countries, the participation rate has literally increased by almost 20 percentage points. On the whole, in the EU, it has increased by 8 percentage points, and more than 51% of the electorate has actually gone to the ballot box and has voted. And so I think this is the first big message. I think this message will rightly be used by many, many people as saying, well, this is a return of Europe. It's a return of the European Parliament's legitimacy. The European Parliament should have an important say on what is next. The second important result, I think, is that the extremist voices have not increased their share in the European Parliament. On the contrary, depending on how you classify the various national parties, we are roughly in the same picture as we were in 2014. We have a 30%, more or less, that have views that are perhaps not as centrist or green, not classified as centrist or green, but the 70% are still basically pro-European, and they stay at 70% roughly compared to 2014. The third, I think, interesting empirical result is in this election is that obviously, the two centrist parties, the center-right and the center-left, so the EPP and the SND, have lost their 50% majority and are even more dependent now than in the future, than they were in the past, on building coalitions with the liberal forces, ALDE, but perhaps also with the Greens. So I think the voters overall have showed they care, and they have showed that they are interested in various topics that were being debated at the national level, but also at the European level. And certainly there has been a shift towards some of the green topics. Now, yesterday evening, the European Council has met here in Brussels. So the European heads of state and government have met here in Brussels to debate, names and who should come into which position. There's lots of gossiping out there. I think many people, many journalists are reporting that there's no agreement as of yet for any of the names, and President Tusk has been tasked with finding a set of names that would square all these various demands. The gossip says that there is a sort of broad agreement in the European Council that among the five top positions, so it's five top positions that need to be filled: the European Commission President, the European Council President, the European Central Bank President, the European Parliament President, and the High Representative for Foreign Affairs. So we have five positions that need to be filled. And President Tusk has been tasked with finding a package that works for everyone, which sort of sounds like a very, very big challenge. And he has, of course, big ambitions to do this very quickly. The gossip also says that among those five, there should be two women, and there should be one East European, and there should be one from the Liberal Party. So this is where I see currently the gossip. What is interesting is, of course, that this is also an institutional battle between the European Council and the European Parliament. And so certainly the European Parliament has been less strong than 5 years ago in endorsing one candidate immediately. But the European Parliament has met yesterday, and the various heads of political groups have met and have discussed what's next. and have endorsed in majority that they would not accept someone who has not been a so-called Spitzenkandidat, a lead candidate, which would, if they stick to that, which would narrow the choice of for the commission president to basically three people, Manfred Weber, Franz Timmermans, and Margrethe Vestager. So this is, I think, where we stand and what is being recorded and reported. Now, what I would like to do in today's podcast is to discuss with my two guests, Ferdinando Giuliani from Bloomberg in Rome. Welcome, Ferdinando.
Thank you, Gunther.
And with Krzysztof Blusz, who's a senior fellow at Wise Europa in Warsaw. Welcome, Krzysztof.
Hello, good morning.
So what I would like to do is to discuss with my two guests, not so much the broader gossip. I think none of us really has any further insights than what we just reported from the press, but to discuss really a distinctive Italian perspective and a distinctive Polish perspective. And perhaps let me start with you, Ferdinando. Ferdinando, you are based in Rome, obviously, and this election has been quite a shake-up for the Italian political landscape. Perhaps you can just walk us through the Italian results and how you see this playing into Italian politics also.
Well, Italy was very much, I think, in contrast with the broader European trend which you've described. There was an absolute triumph by the League, the far-right party, which last year, surprised by becoming the largest party in the center-right coalition, then has been the junior partner to the Five Star Movement in this populist coalition, which has run Italy for a year now. But now Matteo Salvini, the leader of the League, has really taken the League a step forward by turning it into the largest party. They won a third of the votes. Five Star Movement did poorly. They nearly halved their share of the vote compared to the general election last year, and the center-left Democratic Party did a little bit better than last year, but still very, very far behind the League, even though it's now overtaken the Five Star Movement. So there is a purely, there is an interesting domestic dimension, which is at the moment, the coalition government has as its senior partner the Five Star Movement and as junior partner the League. But it's now clear that the balance of power has shifted dramatically. And I think many investors are already asking themselves whether Salvini will want to continue with this coalition of very strange bedfellows, because the two parties have different positions on various issues, from infrastructure to whether to prioritize tax cuts over spending increases, or may want to go for an election trying to seek a mandate to run as a right-wing government. So there is that domestic side, but there is, I think, a very interesting European side. As I wrote in a column I wrote for Bloomberg just this week, the paradox here is that the League is absolutely dominant in Italy, but I would argue risks being pretty irrelevant in the European Parliament. And that's because, as you said, the kind of extreme right-wing parties, the populists, haven't really done very well at these elections, and will almost certainly be in opposition. And so it's very possible that all the demands that Salvini will want to make with regard to changing the fiscal rules to allow Italy to spend more, even changing immigration rules, where I think actually, Italy has a point in demanding greater redistribution across the EU. Well, all these, demands, whether they're right or wrong, will be hard to find, you will find it very hard to find allies which can get them through into Parliament. So I think one important takeaway for me from this election is that the gulf between Italy and the EU, which you've seen forming over the last few years, will just get wider. There will be more resentment in Italy because the EU is not listening to Italy. And at the same time, the EU will look at Italy and say, you are only kind of, the League may be the most important party in this country, but the people of Europe, as you were, have spoken. in a very different way from them spoken in Italy. And I think this contrast bears, bodes very ill for Italy, but also for the EU, because Italy, let's remember, is a founding member of the EU, and that large sovereign debt, you know, is something which everyone worries about.
Well, let's dwell a little bit more into this issue, because I think it's really one of, as you rightly say, I think one of the worrying results of this election is an increasing gulf between Italy and Europe. I mean, currently, Italy holds a number of key European positions. Mario Draghi obviously is not only an Italian, but also a very sort of brilliant president of the European Central Bank, who really managed to overcome quite the financial crisis in 2012, and so he will leave office, and one option is that Jens Weidmann could be his successor, who has been on the record and who has been very strongly against the OMT. Now, then Italy loses the high representative, and Italy in the European Parliament is losing significantly his weight, with perhaps a bit, but even the Partito Democratico, that did relatively well in this election, still did less well than it did 5 years ago. So where does all of us leave us? I mean, one cannot obviously, as you rightly say, Italy is a founding member. Italy has a high debt. So the EU cannot afford to just sort of ignore Italy, ignore the wishes of Italy, the wishes of the Italian voters. But at the same time, it can also not just accommodate fiscal policies that would render Italian debt unsustainable. So where how do you see this conflict playing out in the coming months and years, perhaps?
Well, I think, as I've argued, one of the key questions here, which we don't have an answer to, is how Matteo Salvini wants to play his hand now. I mean, he's been a master tactician in first, winning the primacy in the center-right, and then completely outmaneuvering the five-star movement, which showed themselves to be completely amateurs, and within a year were overtaken comprehensively by the League. But I don't think he's yet told us what his strategy really is. And I think there are a number of things which we need to look at. The first one is the choice of candidates, which Salvini will put forward, almost certainly being now the dominant force in Italy, for the jobs which will come up in Europe. I mean, Italy will need to have a European commissioner. That's what happens to every member state. But of course, if they present, a kind of more moderate compromise candidates, then, chances are the portfolio for this person will be relatively important. But obviously, if they come up with some, pretty unacceptable choice to the rest of Europe, it's pretty clear the weight of Italy in the next commission is going to be much lower. You mentioned the ECB. Of course, losing Mario Draghi is a big, a big deal for Italy. I think it's also a big headache for the rest of Europe. And clearly, whether or not Italy will get a job on the executive board will also depend on other things. For example, if no Frenchman or German is elected as president, chances are that Italy will have to wait anyway. But what happens if, say, Jens Weidmann becomes president, or the French governor, Villeroy de Gaulle? Well, again, I think that will very much depend on the candidate which Italy decides to put forward. If, for example, for example, they could put forward an excellent Italian woman economist like Lucrezia Reichlin. She would have a very strong case to make it to the executive board. But obviously, she's not like-minded at all to Salvini. So he may come up with a different candidate, in which case Italy would lose weight. The other issue which you've mentioned is on fiscal, fiscal matters. We know there is a budget. I mean, even before the budget, the European Commission is likely to ask for greater clarification on the fact that Italy is missing its targets for this year. We remember that last year there was a big tussle over Italy's budget and whether it was breaching European rules over debt. But an even greater battle will be in the autumn, when Italy will need to pass a budget which at the moment should include more than 20 billion in spending cuts, or else more than 20 billion in VAT increases. Now, Salvini is playing, you know, he's kind of really still playing to the gallery by saying that, you know, he has a mandate not to do this. But, you know, we obviously, you know, it's not just Europe and Salvini. There is also the financial markets, which last year were not very kind to Italy up until the compromise with the European Commission. So I would argue that, you know, much of this will depend on what Salvini decides to do, whether he continues to be the populist we've seen so far, or whether he tacks back to, you know, the center, a more pragmatic position. Because let's keep in mind, a lot of his vote comes from the richer areas of the country, the north, and there is a big part within his party which, yes, may like lower taxes, may like fewer immigrants, but really doesn't want to have a financial shock such as the one of Italy leaving the Eurozone. So I think, you know, the next few months will really show us what Salvini is made of, and this will be, I think, crucial for the future of Italy in Europe, but I would argue also of Europe.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Ferdinando. And perhaps the one final remark that I would like to add to the Italian discussion is that obviously any candidate that is being proposed by a member state can be rejected by the nominated commission president if he or she thinks that candidate would not be acceptable in terms of endorsing European values. So we are here in a state also, and President Juncker has done this quite actively. I mean, there were a number of candidates that he very quickly dismissed because he was already seeing that the European Parliament would reject them and would therefore reject the European Commission. So clearly there's lots of checks and balances on the people, but I think you're absolutely right. If it is a moderate candidate, it could be a strong portfolio, but then it's not a portfolio that would be in line with what the leading party in Italy actually wants. Now, let me turn to you, Christoph, on Poland. I mean, the participation rate in Poland was up very significantly, and the leading party, the PIS, has retained an absolute lead. Can you walk us through the Polish debate and what we've seen in Poland?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, the facts and figures are well known by now. I mean, the ruling Law and Justice Party has ensured a sweeping victory in these elections with a turnout unusually high, almost 46%. That was actually twice as much as we witnessed in all the previous European elections. So that was a very significant mobilization of the electorate. But as it turned out, the mobilization actually concerned mostly the followers of the ruling Law and Justice Party and its acolytes. Well, Law and Justice has actually ensured a double victory because it smashed the pro-European center-left liberal coalition of the Civic Platform, the party of the President Tusk, and the associated Polish Peasant Party, the Liberal, Modern, and the Polish Greens, with a lead over them almost 7%, which is a very significant one. The third party in the final results was the new entrant that is called Spring, a very progressive secular party of Robert Biedroń, who is not that new to the Polish politics. He used to be a member of the parliament of the last term in the office. But Law and Justice has ensured a double victory in the sense also that it smashed anything that was emerging on the far right from the party, the nationalistic grouping of parties that border sometimes with anti-Semitism and fascism, that was called Confederation, was actually under the threshold of 5%. So this was a victory that was also very hegemonic in a sense, because if you look into granulars of these elections, into the results, it turned out that Law and Justice managed to mobilize their electorate in almost all the regions of Poland. So when you look into something that is the smallest granular communities of Poland that we called gminas, you would see that PiS achieved a spectacular lead over the coalition of the Civic Platform and all the other pro-Europeans. Well, the reasons behind are obviously multiple, but I think that part of it obviously is the context in which these elections were actually fought. These are very political times in Poland. The Polish politics has been very divisive over the last few years since Law and Justice took the office back in 2015. But at the same time, I think one of the critical aspects of it was a very smart and very clever way of mobilizing the countryside electorate that Law and Justice managed to pursue. They actually, for the very first time, actually, they made the countryside electorate interested in Europe as an issue. And that was a very smart way of portraying Europe as being threatened, this traditional Europe based on Christian values being threatened by the postmodern or late modern, if you like, lifestyles, axiological advances, and both public and foreign policies of the European Union, because what PiS, Law and Justice did, they went to see the electorate under the flag of let's defend Europe that we belong to and it's important for us. And that was obviously reflected in the slogan that they choose for the election, that was Poland at the heart of Europe. But that was so, sort of a bit of perverse turn around as far as the Law and Justice policies and approaches to European Union are concerned.
So can I just ask you, sorry, can I just interrupt you here and ask you to dwell a little bit more on sort of what were really the issues in the campaign on Europe? Because you mentioned PiS, Law and Justice Party, and you contrasted them in your description with the pro-European parties, but then you say that they themselves have actually run a pro-European campaign by saying Poland at the heart of Europe and actually pushing a number of European topics, but just with a different approach, perhaps more traditional values, perhaps on the economic side, more emphasis on strengthening the single market. So I mean, is it actually fair to characterize PiS and Law and Justice as an anti-European party, or is it rather fair to characterize them as a party that endorses more traditional values, but wants the European Union and the European project still to succeed? I mean, how would you characterize that?
Well, you know, one needs to understand that what Europe means for the Law and Justice is not something that would have much to do with the current model on which the European Union is functioning. That was the reason primarily for the Law and Justice to associate themselves within the European Parliament with the group of the British Eurosceptics. Law and Justice is definitely Eurosceptic.
Sorry, that's the Tories, right? I mean, so it's the Tories. It wasn't UKIP, right?
Just to be clear. It wasn't UKIP, obviously. But still, you know, the Europe that Law and Justice promotes is the Europe of nations, right? It's more of the economic project. It's not the project that would assume much of the political coordination. And obviously, when Law and Justice was campaigning prior to the elections, they were actually promoting these risks that Europe was exposed to, the Europe that they believed in. And the risks were actually the risk emanating from the identity politics, minority rights, the policies that would ensure more coordination. And I mean, obviously, the policy on migration, on euro, on the climate and environmental issues, all the policies that would assume more coordination within the political coordination as well within the EU was something that was presented by President Kaczynski and Chairman Kaczynski as a threat to this traditional Christian Europe. So this is the reason that I'm saying that despite what you see on the face value and this pro-European stance, Europe at the heart, Poland at the heart of Europe, the actually perversion behind was that what Law and Justice was promoting and mobilizing the electorate around was a different kind of Europe that you would find within Eurosceptic echelons in the European Union.
So Krzysztof, what does PiS and the Law and Justice Party now want from the new European leadership? I mean, do they just want to get rid of Franz Timmermans' tough line on the rule of law, or what are the key things they would like to see, and who could as a person represent those interests in what kind of position? If you can give a bit of your speculation from the Polish point of view.
Right. This electoral victory for the Law and Justice was obviously a kind of a sweet and sour. It was sweet because that gave them a massive win in the country. But I think it may prove to be really sour because for the time being, at least, they basically are heading towards a situation where they find themselves, in a sense, in this one of the small groupings that would be basically competing with the European quartet now in the European Union. The question that is really very important is, and this is in a sense also ironic enough, that we are a very distinct country altogether with Italy and also with Hungary, we haven't discussed today. But we are not in sync in Europe. The question remaining is what the political mainstream in the EU is going to do with these countries, how these countries are going to be dealt with. And this includes the questions about law and justice. Is law and justice going to find itself teaming up with small Eurosceptic groupings that has won seats in parliament in other countries, or there is a chance that the political mainstream in Europe and EPP particularly will find out that accommodation of law and justice may prove attractive to them? This is a key question, I think, about the future of the European Parliament and also the role of law and justice in Europe. Law and justice has been sending a very heavy team of people. There are really heavyweights, the party loyals of Chairman Kaczynski to the European Parliament, including the former Prime Minister Szydło, who has actually ensured a massive result for herself, almost 5 million votes, one of the best results in these elections. There are some other prominent personalities behind. You still need to remember that there will be two people who have been very experienced in the European Games, two intellectuals, academics, who used to be MEPs in the previous term or the current term of the European Parliament, who are very close to the Chairman Kaczynski's ear, Professor Krasnodębski and Professor Legutko. So we shall see. This is a sort of also a vantage point for law and justice to decide how they deal with the European Union during the term in the European Parliament, what kind of ambitions and what they want to pursue. And, you know, all these is happening within the context that this election was fought as a sort of a, you know, test or a pilot before the parliamentary elections that we will have in the autumn of 2019.
Yes. I mean, the good news, thank you for this this view. I mean, the good news is obviously that all of this is being discussed and debated and will be happening in the European Parliament, which in a sense is a paradox that, you know, in a federal institution, a federal parliament, we have also now a significant grouping from Poland and from Italy that, you know, will sort of be there and will debate a different way of doing Europe, but will still do it in the context of the EU, just as much as UKIP and even the Tories did in the last 5 years in the European Parliament. Perhaps, Ferdinando, one reaction or two reactions to the idea of the Liga and PiS working together, or alternatively, perhaps PiS working with the EPP. Any views on how that could play out in the European Parliament?
Well, I mean, I think there are two points. One is, yes, they may try to work together, but I still think that, you know, this is just the way minorities, oppositions decide to work together. And I think it's going to be rather irrelevant in the great scheme of things, which is really, you know, whether the new majority is going to be any different in the results it produces from the past one. There is another point, which I think is more fundamental, and it's whether these, you know, Italy first, Poland first, Hungary first movements can actually work together. And I'll give you one example that Salvini's been talking for, you know, forever about the fact that if the populists, the anti-establishment forces would win this election, he would be able to push for, you know, more greater fiscal stimulus. But it's pretty clear that a lot of the, you know, other nationalist parties across Europe are clearly unsupportive of the idea of Italy going for a big fiscal stimulus, because they fear this would be, you know, it would end up being them paying for Italy one way or another. Obviously, this is true within the Eurozone, less true when you're looking at, or, you know, the other example is over immigration. You know, he wants to have more redistribution of immigrants, asylum seekers in particular, across Europe. But we know that it's Hungary, for example, his good friend Viktor Orban, who is opposed to reforming, you know, the existing rules over the way asylum seekers are distributed within the EU. So there is this glaring contradiction of, you know, which is intrinsic to the idea of a coalition of nationalists. Yes, they may agree that, you know, mainstream parties are bad, that the EU needs to change or even disappear, but then they completely disagree over what the future outlook should be. And I think that point remains, you know, remains there, regardless of how well or badly they do in a given election.
Okay, I think that's all the time we have for this podcast. Thank you so much, Ferdinando, for joining us. Thank you so much, Christoph, for joining us. I think it was really important to zoom in a little bit on both Poland and Italy with their election results that, in a sense, differ quite a bit from the overall trend. Thank you to both of you.